From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to the Datebook Podcast. I'm Chronicle pop culture critic Peter Hartlob, here with reporter Ideen Vaziri. Welcome, Ideen.
Thank you for having me.
So we have Robert Mailer Anderson today. Interview has already happened. I had a really good time. Quite a Bay Area character. How'd you guys meet?
Well, one time I made a list of the worst bands in the history of rock and roll, as you do as a pop music critic. Yeah. And I got a ton of letters.
And the number one, we should... was
one stood out in particular. Oh, the number one band was Pearl Jam.
Yeah. Okay. I disagree, but go on.
I know. Write a letter. But one of the letters that stood out was like, has there been a worse writer in the history of mankind? Riffing on my list. And it started, you know, it listed a monkey with a typewriter. And then out of the blue, it said Robert Mailer Anderson. So I had to meet him because there's only two terrible writers in San Francisco. So we met, we hit it off, and we've been writing terribly ever since.
I love that you bonded over an angry Chronicle letter writer. Not the worst writer in the world. Boonville was a great, great novel. People locally love it and beyond. He had a movie, Pig Hunt, which I remember it was like a drive-in horror thing. And he's got a new movie, Windows on the World. I think people will be surprised. Totally different direction.
Yeah, it's a topical movie, and it addresses the current immigration crisis. But it's set around 9/11, and it's about a family in Mexico where the patriarch feels the need to provide for his family. So he finds his way into America, ends up working in the Windows on the World restaurant on the top of the Twin Towers. And then the planes go into the building. And so here's this person who is undocumented, unaccounted for, and his son comes to find him. And
also undocumented coming up.
Exactly.
He's got to cross the border. We're going to go spoiler-free with this, but there's a lot of great surprises in it. You'll have to wait to see it. It's on the festival circuit now, but the soundtrack with members of Los Lobos, the SF Jazz Collective, and Charlie Musselwhite, who's in the movie, a lot of Bay Area ties, that's out on August 2nd.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful, eclectic soundtrack that, even though the movie is not set in the Bay Area, it feels like a Bay Area soundtrack, and it's really cool.
Yeah, and Robert, as he mentions in the recording, you will get to see this movie. It'll be out later this year. One final note, we had a little bit of an audio problem. You'll hear a transition near the end. Apologize for that. Datebook Podcast, thanks for listening.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome to the San Francisco Chronicle.
It's great to
Robert
be here.
Robert Mailer Anderson. Have you been here before? We brought you through.
I have been a couple times.
Yeah.
I've come over to see the newsroom and to see how the news goes and to greet other friends here over the years. But it's changed a little bit, and my memory isn't so great either about that. But
now, you have a news background in your family.
Absolutely. Yeah. My uncle, Bruce Anderson, is the editor, publisher of the Anderson Valley Advertiser. And he started publishing me when I was about 15 after he took over the newspaper and fully believed that, a newspaper has no friends and you have to be as radical as reality itself. He sort of took on Mendocino County like a beat cop, like everybody's sort of used to with the newspapers. And I think a lot of people thought it would be short-lived. He would burn out or someone would kill him. And I think he's done it now. He just turned 80 the other day. I think it's over 35 years.
And still working.
still working is, you know, and people always say, you know, did that happen on specific articles? And we always say, well, that's the way we're telling it.
Yeah.
What were some of the early assignments he gave you when you started writing for his newspaper?
I did movie reviews, and I would do one of the things we called just taking out the garbage was the MCOE meetings. And so he, at one point, for the second time, got in a fight and punched out the superintendent of schools, who was my former principal at Ukiah High, and he was banned from the meetings. And my other uncle, Robert Major Anderson, had done it. And my dad, Ken Anderson, had covered those meetings. And I think my cousin, Zach, had also covered those meetings. And so it was clearly my turn to take out the garbage and do the MCOE meetings. But I would write very thinly veiled, poor stuff like Fear and Loathing at Ukiah High. You know, my version of Hunter S. Thompson and Bad Attitudes. And then I would do interviews with, like, Kelvin Chapman, who was a local baseball player. I remember doing a restaurant review. And I remember, you know, at a certain point, I was Scoop Anderson during an informal internship. You know, a piece of airplane would fall on a farm in Philo, and you'd go out and check it out, or you'd do the local elections. You know, I cut my teeth doing that kind of stuff, but I was always playing fast and loose with the facts. And always in opposition, even of Bruce, I had my own axe to grind. And Bruce would be around the table sometimes with all the other kind of local heroes from around the Bay Area that you guys are probably all familiar with, people like Fred Gardner and Warren Hinkle and his only real friend forever, really, Alexander Coburn. And, you know, Bruce would not run pieces of mine. And instead of just red inking them, he would just pull Joseph Mitchell, off the shelves, or he would give me George Orwell, and he would say, read this, you know.
that was kind of like your practice for writing your first novel, Boonville. That was kind of your training ground writing for the newspaper, right?
Well, so my father was an English teacher before he was kind of soundly run out of Tamalpais High School. He taught at Novato High, and he was kind of, there was a period where you could be a jock and kind of an intellectual. It was short-lasted, brought on by the recently death of Jim Boughton is kind of one of those guys, or the professor Jim Brosnan. And so if you remember, like, even those Burt Reynolds films, you know, like of A Semi-Tough or the Pete Gentry North Dallas 40, there were kind of wiseacre guys who were kind of doing the thing. And so my uncle and my dad, they all kind of fell into that. And so my dad helped unionize the first teachers union in Marin County, and he was the president of that. And then, you know, times were very radical with the free speech movement in Vietnam and the Brown Power movement and the Black Panthers. And he was completely involved with all of that to the point where he was accused, never convicted, of helping one of his students set four bombs off, two in B of A's. And then along with a lot of other stuff. So he was sort of drummed out of that. And him and my uncle both started homes for juvenile delinquents. So one of the kind of interesting things I think about myself is that I believe that by the time I was 18, my folks were divorced. And so by the time I was 18, my mom and dad separately had about 25, 26 different residencies by the time I was 18. So we moved a lot. And then I was partially raised by my grandparents. On my mom's side, and my grandfather was a prison guard who fought in World War II and then re-upped for the Berlin Airlift and then Korea. I was a tough guy. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was half Mexican, born in Rust, which has since become El Cerrito, but it was Rust at the time, Rust, California. Her mom died. She was raised at a convent by nuns here in San Francisco, and she's the Mexican side of my family. And, you know, her family, my family, the Martinezes and the Higueras and the Barandas were some of the first settlers to California. So I'm like ninth or tenth generation. We fought against the U.S. invasion of Mexico, mm-hmm. otherwise known as the Mexican-American War. And we had to surrender in Monterey. So my dad always said, well, it's all good writing material. So as much as I'd like to credit Bruce with some of that, my dad always gave me fiction. My dad always told me to kind of, I don't know if it was a defense mechanism, but to look at life as a narrator, to kind of remove yourself in a way, so that you could see what's happening in a way, to kind of bear witness, and then to try to translate that into film. I mean, to sentences, to words, to language, to story, so that you can corroborate what you're seeing is actually happening. And so things became very radical and very crazy very early in my life, and I was trying to piece it together. And so as much as Bruce was giving me those kind of people to read, my dad was giving me a steady diet of Flannery O'Connor and John Steinbeck and other sort of handbooks about how to read the world, and radicalism too, you know, from Autobiography of Malcolm X, Felix Green's The Enemy, Man, Child, and the Promised Land. I mean, this was all just sort of standard equipment. And we read, too, as a defense mechanism before writing.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about your... No, don't ever apologize. We're going to talk a little bit about your new movie, Windows on the World, which I greatly enjoyed. I mean, a collection of artists and personalities, both on screen and behind the screen, behind the camera. But I wonder, like, did you realize when you were young that collecting these personalities in your life, these family stories, this history, might benefit you later on as a writer and even as a filmmaker? Were you even thinking about film?
I was always thinking about film, too. I was raised at the movie theater. I think you said that you're a couple years younger than me. Yeah. But I was raised at a time, too, you know, a California first state to have no-fault divorce, divorced families, working class, underclass families. You would get in the summer especially movie money.
Yeah,
you get like $2, and in the matinees and underage, you know, as a child it was $1. And my father would say, oh, let's, you know, on the hot days he'd go, let's go buy some air conditioning. And so we would go see, you know, anything.
What were your theaters?
Oh, well, so again, I'm a little schizophrenic in terms of where my home is. So born in San Francisco, and because I've lived here so much, and my father, during the divorce, he was much more interested in coming into the city than he was going back to San Rafael, which was where I was raised until I was 13. And my uncle Bruce, who I'm very close with, and so it makes sense to continue to talk about him. Also, in terms of Windows on the World, I co-wrote that with my cousin Zach, who's his oldest child. And so they... Not to get more into family history, but Bruce, after, you know, being a juvenile delinquent, somewhat like my dad, he was given a choice to join the Marines or go to jail, essentially. And so he joined the Marines, came out of the belly of the beast, and then joined the Peace Corps, went to Malaysia, and his radicalism there got him in trouble, where he was given, rumor has it, 24 hours, 48 hours to get the hell out of the country, because the beginning of the domino theory over there. Mm-hmm. And they apparently killed everybody on his basketball team. And he got out of the country. But he had a son, Zach, and a wife, my Aunt Ling, that were there. So we had to send for them. And when he sent for them and they finally could come, they lived in a Chinese tenement building. So we were raised in and around Chinatown, too. We being Zach and I. And my dad would go in there. And being a good beat, remember, North Beach is right up against Chinatown. So uncles and oiloy goys and all that was, you know, stomping grounds and also cheap eats, you know. Yeah. For a quarter, you could get a pork bun, which doesn't cut into your movie money. You know? Like, so the theaters then were some of the theaters on Market Street. We did hit the Castro. I remember, like, the Strand, the Cannery. There would be all these kind of art house places as well. And he would take us to see things like Claudine, you know, like, you know, other sort of, you know, problem films, or, you know, like other things that captivated him. And then... the Rafael Theater, for sure, and then every theater in Marin that had their own name of the town, really.
Sure.
You know, the Fairfax, and we also had the drive-ins, the cinema, and we would also, over here near the Cow Palace, we would go to those drive-ins.
Yeah, the Geneva.
The Geneva.
Which lasted a while.
A long time.
Yeah.
Past its day.
Yeah.
And then he moved up to Mendocino County, you know, we're talking around 75, and my uncle was already there. And so the Ukiah Theater, and then the Ukiah Drive-In, and then the Cloverdale Theater, where Zach and I saw Robert Mitchum's Yakuza, you know, because it was just a hot day and we just went in. You know, our parents didn't really care. It wasn't looked upon that way, or we were not getting that kind of guidance.
Were you reading like at a young age?
Yeah.
Cervantes, but Cervantes is a framing device, and I'm not gonna. This is gonna be a spoiler free podcast, but Cervantes quotes are a Don Quixote quotes are a framing device in the film. Were you reading that at a young age? What types of things were you reading early on? Were you kind of
advanced reading,
in that way?
We weren't reading Cervantes. I wasn't reading Cervantes. Zach might have.
Yeah.
Zach had different reading lists than I did. But we were reading early on anything we could get our hands on, including the newspapers, True, and the columnists. We were looking at Herb Cain. And we went... There was a point, I think like fourth or fifth grade, when we just made the switch. And so at school, there's like, I would either be getting into fights or I would be reading in the library alone, just with the same sort of intensity that you might throw a first punch, you know, or duck. And so right around fifth grade, I remember starting to grab like James Bond, you know, and then that leads in towards to, you know, all of a sudden you're reading like Mickey Spillane novels, you know. And then my dad giving me stuff like, you know, the primer sources of like John Steinbeck and not The Grapes of Wrath, but, you know, Sweet Thursday, Oddly First, and then Cannery Row. And then, you know, you're reading The Pony and, you know, The Pearl is not, you know, never my favorite. But, you know, you're so that becomes adult fiction, right?
Yeah, a lot of us read those books because we had to. Somebody put them in front of us, and it sounds like you were doing it voluntarily, which I think is telling.
One of the things that happened when Marin did have better public schools than Ukiah and Mendocino County and Boonville, you know, and so most of my life I've been reading the text before it was given to me in classroom, so it's all a training ground. So then when you're 15 and you start writing for My Uncle Bruce, or when you're 18 or 19 or 20, you start trying to write a novel. And I felt Boonville, if I couldn't make sense of the characters out of Boonville and the constant flow of information around the AVA, then I should just give it up. You know, I mean, that's pretty pathetic. But poor follow through on the second one. But working on it and have done a bunch of other things in the meantime. But again, never stop thinking that it's all good writing material.
I'm curious what drew you and Zach to telling the immigrant story based on a story around 9/11. Why was that the peg for telling the story of Windows on the World?
Well, there was so many. I mean, lottery. 9/11 was the big, you know, a big event in a way, and the biggest event that to hear our country tell it in a really long time. So that made an interesting focus. Also, there was a whole, you know, why us? How can people hate us? Like, you know. And it was the World Trade Center. So you're talking again. We were raised as communists and socialists and social anarchists. You know, like, you know, again, back to what we had to read. We had to read Homage to Catalonia and almost, you know, be able to recite what the different, you know, parts of the Spanish Revolution were in terms of party structure. So we looked at commerce, and we were always trying to tell working class stories in a way, because that's who we are for the most part. And so that seemed like a really good spinner. Also, I came home from a weekend away with the kids, and the New York Times had New York Times Magazine had a photo essay of families holding pictures of loved ones that they said were in the building, and they were from all around the world. And I was moved to tears. And I was like, and I told Zach, I was like, that's our story. That's our way in. Not only are these working class people never, you know, that we know and we went to school with and we are kind of, you know, of a little bit unseen and underappreciated, especially the migrant workers around Anderson Valley. The whole workforce, all of labor, you know, all the Eugene Debs stuff we got, all the, you know, here's a way to look at labor, and here's a way to look at labor, not just in America, but how America affects everybody, you know? And so then we're like, well, what do we know and where can we set it that makes the most visual sense and everything? And so we're like, well, Mexico, of course, because that's kind of what we know a little bit more. And it's we've always pictured that scene in the desert of a crossing. Of various kinds, you know, to get here. The trick, of course, is then, you know, why New York as opposed, you know, I lived in New York for 5 years. I think there were only 60,000 Mexicans there, but the, you know, people always have a reason to get somewhere. And if you talk to immigrants about how they ended up in Des Moines or how they ended up in Portland, and you know, there's usually a trail and a train, sometimes not. Yeah. Sometimes somebody just knows somebody, and it like anything else sounds like a good idea, you know? And so we went at it. We went at it, and we always knew that there would be a reckoning between father and son. And so with that proposition, we set out to try to tell the story.
Right. Yeah. So for those who haven't seen the movie yet, it's based on the Windows on the World restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, but it's about this family in Mexico where the patriarch comes to America, crosses into America legally to provide for the family, and he's undocumented, working in the World Trade Center, and the planes hit, and then from there it becomes his son's quest to find out what happened to him, because there's no record of his.
The family's in Mexico, and you see everybody stunned, like we all were, by the attacks and the buildings going down, and then, you know, one of the family says, that's where Dad worked, and you know, now they got to see if he's okay, but there's no way except for him calling, and he doesn't call. And so they have a hard time, because he doesn't exist in America, figuring out what happened to him. And they kind of assume that he's dead until the mother, who's a little bit of an unreliable narrator at this point due to trauma, swears that she sees him getting out of the building alive on news footage. Right. So the youngest son takes his savings and crosses the border to look for someone who's either dead or doesn't want to be found, also for possible closure and for other reasons.
But with great challenges, because there were so many services then, but he can't use them all because he's in the same position his father was in.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he's literally living on the streets because he doesn't have New York money. And again, you can't just get on a plane for any particular reason. And then they were also cutting down the crossings of the borders anyway. So he doesn't have that kind of money. He has to take a bus. And then he has to look for his dad in a pretty low to the ground, hard scrabble way. And then he gets a job from a Nigerian gentleman to wash windows, to extend the metaphor of windows on the world. And instead of maybe your Anglo white guy, you know, riding shotgun or helping, you know, we decided in the end that it should be somebody whose country has experienced civil war, and where, you know, 2 million people were dead inside of like 5 years, to give a little scope and another outside idea of what the rest of the world is going on, you know, there. And, you know, so it's a Nigerian immigrant that comes to New York that sees this kid and helps him.
Yeah.
And to make the movie, you actually had to recreate these scenes in New York of post 9/11 with the pictures of the missing people on the street. How did that go over?
So again, I lived in New York for 5 years, and I was waiting for I would say maybe half the people to be angry about it. It's certainly, you know, someone's going to be angry about something in New York, especially if you're making these, oh my God, Jay, what's the word? Remember we made the, what do we call them?
Shrines.
Shrines. We're making shrines. Thank you, Jay. we had to make the shrines especially, and they're very public as we constructed them. Not one person complained, and people came up to us. And we paused because we were trying to be, you know, sensitive to it. And we had to hear and did hear their stories. We bore witness to a lot of other people's stories, a lot of tears, and a lot of people telling us at the time, before we even made the movie, before it was, you know, they could see anything, just by what we were trying to do, thank you. And that it was cathartic for them to see this and to re-experience this. And they were like, thank you for doing this from a working, you know, and the immigrant perspective too, not, you know, from necessarily the fireman or from a businessman who just happens not to be at home, but from another perspective that again is going untold and, you know, really resonates with a lot of people. Not that the other stories don't, because they certainly do. But our story was, you know, much more closer to home, I think, in terms of, again, being immigrants in a nation of immigrants and one generation, no generation, five generations off or something, you know. And so it became, it tapped into everybody's psyche about what their story was and why they came and what they wanted, you know. And here we were, and here we are grieving, you know. Here is this trauma. How do we get through the trauma after the other trauma of crossing and leaving and disrupting family, you know? How do we get through this other trauma of being attacked for what we are, or what we've become, or what we want to be? It just resonated with people. That's partially when I knew we were right on the right track with the film, into a deeper resonance. When we've been playing at festivals, we haven't had one screening where I haven't seen somebody cry,
yeah,
or that somebody has come up to us afterwards and said we've cried. And in fact, Zach and I were crying when we wrote the thing, which is a little goofy. And we have a graphic novel version done that's going to come out via Fantagraphics. And the illustrator, John Sack, said that he just reread back through everything because we're doing a global edit. And he in fact cried again. And it's different places because it is, you know, the immigrant story is big. Father and son stories are big in terms of family disruption. And then, you know, 9/11 is just the backdrop.
You've taken this film to different distributors. It's been a challenge selling it, even though you have Edward James Olmos in it, and you have this fantastic soundtrack with the members of Los Lobos and members of the SF Jazz Collective. And it's a, you know, completed, finished, beautiful film. Why are some of the reasons people are not willing to pick it up, these major studios?
There's a picture here I just happened to see of Boots Riley on the wall.
Yeah.
Here. So, I mean, we're up against corporate America.
Yeah.
And we can talk all we want about who should do what and where, but it gets to be a small number of true distributors that would put out a film like this. And they're not going for it because they're the same people, for the most part, that told us that you couldn't have a girl as the lead in an action film, you know, until you have The Hunger Games or, you know, or The Mockingbird, whatever the hell, right? Or you certainly couldn't have a girl in an animated film because boys won't see that either until you have Frozen, right? And you damn well can't have a black guy, you know, in a superhero film because who's going to see that? You know, so the universal truth is, again, like kind of a heteronormative white male, and we'll all see that. And basically, that's who's in charge of studios and decision making. And then they have to decide that, lo and behold, you could see truth, yourself, humanity, in another sex, another ethnicity than their own. If you go through the org charts, not just in Silicon Valley, but if you go into the org charts in Hollywood, you're not going to see Latinos in charge. And so it becomes very difficult, and you're not pitching that many people. And Hollywood is historically full of cowardice, just, you know, rampant with it, and a hypocrisy for all of their celebration every Oscar year or something. You know, it's a corporate world. And they're also under siege by Netflix creating a huge power play and a monopoly. Since the 40s, I believe, you know, they were trying to separate, you know, the distributors. I mean, basically the movie theaters from the people that make them, right? Because that's a monopoly. And they're one in the same now. So they're streaming. They own it, and they have the means to put it out there. On top of that, they're buying several theaters so that they also qualify for Academy Awards. So little films that were working the margins by people who believed that they had quality, right, would occupy maybe that space, and Netflix is eating that up too. Mm-hmm. You know, they bought The Egyptian and some other stuff. And so it's really difficult. Again, Latinos mean different. Cubans in Florida are not, you know, Mexicans in Southern LA or, you know, Northern California or Guatemala. It's a different thing to say Latino, but 60 million Latinos, biggest group ethnically that goes to movies. You'd think somebody would economically push the button, aside from the fact that the film works. But they'll also tell you to your blue in the face that, oh, well, I guess you can do Crazy Rich Asians, but so because rom-coms, the Chinese rom-com to work. But God forbid that, like, Latino drama, especially around people raised on telenovelas, especially around a whole nation that could use some catharsis from the news, you know, where people, families are being, you know, separated at the border, kids are being, you know, separated from parents, that we could use a little empathy and catharsis and a conversation starter, that would fly.
So what?
But it's not.
What's your workaround? How are you showing it to people? How are you getting it out there?
There's another kind of industry that I'm a little bit familiar with from having done a lot of nonprofit work, which is basically the festival industry. And kind of like, you guys are writers, like it's in the same way that you write your novel often and it's difficult to get an agent, like that becomes a whole process in its own. And the agent may or may not get you your book contract even, but you have to go do that dance. That's what the festivals are sort of like. So there's this other adjunct of, again, mostly upper middle class white people in charge of showing the film, that usually the festivals run are nonprofits that run very much like my experience with SF Jazz, or I was on the board of SF Opera, or, you know, I know the ballet and other things. You oftentimes on a cocktail napkin run 50% donations, 50%, you know, attendance, you know, ticket sales, right? So who are they looking at to show up? And then who are they looking at for advertising? And then who are they looking at to be the big donors? Back to corporate America, back to org charts, and they don't see it as being that Latino stories are gonna move the needle. But you walk around with EJO, Edward James Olmos, and yeah, he's a hero in those communities. They know everything he's done. You know, and from Zoot Suit via, you know, Battlestar Galactica to American Me, and it's super important. Or you'll get a kind of reverse thing about Ryan Guzman, our lead, where here's somebody that was in the last couple Step Up films that made, you know, I don't know, $120 million worldwide. And yet, you know, he's on this show called the number one drama on Fox called 911. And somehow that doesn't equate to it. Mm-hmm. But if you were, you know, somebody that used to be in a John Hughes film or something, well, now here we go. And again, I don't have anything against those particular stories or those particular people, but it just seems that the bandwidth would be wide enough to show something else. And independent film has been something that's been a misnomer for a long time. You know, if Clint Eastwood's making independent film, then, you know, I don't have a chance.
Yeah, and we have these discussions. I'm in the San Francisco Film Critics Circle, and we actually created a committee and several people of color on the committee who are just looking for films that are hard to find. And I think the negative is that, you know, those films are hard to find for a reason that you just mentioned. The positive is that we now have the resources when a film is good that people can look and find those films and tell people in a way that doesn't have to involve the corporations. And I
think that's the, that's a tough flip side that you're absolutely right about.
Yeah.
Which is at some point, somewhere, especially given the net, people just bootleg this and watch it, right? And that's in some ways partly fine with me. Don't tell anyone, but I've never done anything to actually try to make money my whole life. Never been my outtake ever. I've chosen projects once in a while thinking that, this might have a little bit more viability or something. So, you know, why not this one as opposed to, you know, all things being equal. But I've never done anything because of the money that way. So if it gets out there and has its effect, great. We made this film also because we sold it to Miramax a long time ago. I think like 2003. Like, we had this idea and we wrote it. And then it went into turnaround, and doing a lot of work, political work, and some of it a little more conservative than my family would normally do. You know, I did a bunch of work for Obama and trying to help, you know, hold her with gerrymandering and stuff like that, and other political candidates. They continued to tell us, including our attorney general, hey, we have to change the narrative. Aren't you a writer? Aren't you a storyteller? And so we need films like this to be out there so that we can change hearts and minds, so that everybody's image of Latinos isn't gangbangers and maids or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in my head, I'm like, well, all right, we got to change 50,000 votes across those three states, right? So it has to play those malls. So there were concerns about that as well that we did do. It's not in Spanish. You know, it's not, it's with a American cast. You know, they're not from Mazatlan where it's set. So there are those kind of considerations. And so I do think it will get out there. The downside is I don't know how many people like myself there are, and I don't mean that in a self-congratulatory way, but if you can't do things, if it's not viable for profit, then that's going to cut way, 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 way back. And there's a design here to lessen the value of something because it's Hispanic, because it's Mexican, you know, like that just, you know, take $5 off. You know, in the same way that, like, you know, you get Chinese food. How much are you paying for pork fried rice? You know, like, that's only, it's got a cap. French food, on the other hand, or, you know what I mean? You can, you know, thanks to Charles Fang for, you know, changing some of that around a little bit, but with the slanted door. But, do you know, like, it has to be viable. And right now, especially Amazon and Netflix and people, they've created a system such that people will do good work and they'll snap it up for nothing. And it just makes it hard for other people to do that, because then you go back to Hollywood with a good product and the first thing they look at was, how much did it make? And you tell them nothing and they're like, well, see, you know, you don't get to do it. Right now, though, I'm, you know, super, very, very happy about what's happening, mostly in Oakland, seems to me, with, you know, Sorry to Bother You and...
Blind Spotting.
Yeah. I really like Blind Spotting. Yeah. My best friends growing up was... We had a lot of those conversations, him being black and me being white. And that was, there's fantastic, important moments in that film.
Yeah, digging deep into the Quickway hamburger stand. That was, I used to live a couple blocks from there.
I used to go to the Serenader that wasn't so far from yeah, the Quickway.
Well, let's, anyway. if you don't mind, let's talk about, so you were living above Cafe Trieste in an SRO. Writing.
Absolutely.
But your personal fortunes changed. So you'd come up, you know, lower class in Marin. And through marriage, class. You
came into money. We always joke that my wife and I made our money the old fashioned way. You know, she inherited it and I married it.
So how did that change your values or your perspective on the world?
It's always hard because when you get older, it's not one particular event. You know, it's a lot of things that put you on different paths. And so as you go along those paths, you learn different things. I never really lived in San Francisco and wanted to live here, but could really only afford to live in an SRO. And so I didn't go into, there was a murder in like 6 weeks later. And the one I chose was a pretty benign place in kind of North Beach, which would fit me perfectly. And I set about writing, and I jot coffee at Trieste, which was fantastic. And then I met my wife. I did a lot of personal work to get to that particular place. And then when for my family it was very difficult. It was very much guess who's coming to dinner. Like if you fall in love with, you know, somebody who had money, like that's the enemy, and all people with money are horrible people. And so it challenged me that way. I think it's still challenging my family, because some of them, I think, who didn't think I was a horrible person, you know, the day that you have a bank account, you know, am I a horrible person then? Like, yeah, I've never had a checking account until I met my wife, for example. And so that threw me into a different world of challenging my perceptions and misconceptions of things. And then in some ways, you know, it kept me away from the darker parts of myself in terms of trying to write. I mean, that's the truth. I took on other stories, and Zach and I started to write together as well because I started having children, and that changed. If I didn't meet my wife, I don't think I would have had children. And so I could only handle a coffee and 8 hours of doing that with somebody. And writing scripts is, you know, you can do that together. There's not a lot of grace in sentences. And it's good camaraderie. And Zach and I were, you know, two peas in a pod and finishing each other's sentences. And it's not lonely. But then you come into this sense of what can you do to try to change, I guess, your own nature, but the nature of your community, too. And that has occupied a lot of time. And then also, how does money really work past, you know, some Bernie Sanders type broad approach, which is not very nuanced, or my parents not very nuanced kind of approach. You know, I used to do my dad's taxes when, you know, fill them out for him when I was 16, 17. And even then I was like, these numbers don't work. And he'd say, just put the numbers in. You know, they weren't good with money. Yeah. And they didn't really know how it worked, even on a small budgetary level, let alone on a large global level, let alone on a personal level. And so, you know, me and my wife just had 20 years of marriage, and I've spent 20 years a time, you know, in financial meetings and also seeing how things work in terms of economics, in terms of possibly what you can do in terms of arts. I clearly did a bunch of work for SF Jazz to try to raise $65 million for the first standalone building for jazz in America.
Hey, congratulations on that. That's a wonderful building.
It's awesome. And again,
I'm not the target demographic, and I go there because it's just got a good vibe, and
well, the architects did a great job, as did Randall, as did Jazz. I mean, we knew that was viable. I mean, there's another thing that we heard. You know, you're not going to be able to make the building, and if you make the building, it's no one's going to come. And I think we're dealing with a crazy 96% capacity in both venues, and this is our like sixth season. So all the naysayers, including a lot of people who are on the board, you know, we kind of proved them wrong. And but that was really wonderful, and it got me involved again in a hardscrabble way of how to raise funds and what that means in nonprofits. I had done some of that before. And then also I got to use my skills to come up with the campaign slogans like "The World is Listening," or to see that there was a cross-pollination of donors between the MoMA and us potentially, and that we could steal those donors by putting together photography books, you know, and that all photographers that are worth their salt seem to be listening to jazz in the dark rooms. So they were donating stuff, no problem. And then we'd have to get their, you know, their patrons to see what was motivating them.
Well, we can close it all up, bringing it back to the movie. People who listen to the soundtrack or see the movie are going to hear some familiar voices. And Charlie Musselwhite is in the movie, I believe, carrying a shotgun.
Yep.
Which is fantastic. My parents live up in Healdsburg and see him at coffee. And there's a lot of other people, too. It's not a San Francisco movie. It goes from Mazatlan to New York, but it's a San Francisco Bay Area movie with your ears, I feel like.
It's I was raised eclectically, and so I've always had friends, luckily, that are artists and stuff too, as well as just, my friends from Little League, parents ran Giorgio's, pizzeria and stuff, like, so there's a combination of people, but I lean really heavy on my musician friends because the budget got killed and we had to use the song New York, New York in the movie because I couldn't figure my way around it. And I even asked my musician friends, well, what other song is like it? And the answer is none. Mm-hmm. So we had to get to work writing songs and recording them. And so Charlie, who was actually also in our Ode to the Drive-In Pig Hunt, he's like a brother. All these people are like brothers, so it becomes, it sounds like it's something to say, like in Hollywood, but, I lean on these people heavily, both artistically and otherwise. So Eric Harland, right away, on board. What do you need? How can I put this together? Okay, sing the song as well as you can into, Jai's phone. We'll send it out. Let's talk about it. Who can we get? I can record it in New York. The Collective, five guys from The Collective came in, and Jeff Cressman, one of the recording engineers at SF Jazz, they gave us time, 2 hours or hour and a half before they went on stage. Mm-hmm. And they, recorded this Every Tear I Cry For You song and Don't Break My Heart Again, and then gave us other stuff. Ethan Iverson comes in, before his gig with the Bad Plus and has written something for me. And then we play a stump the band kind of thing of I tell him a scenario and he makes something up on the spot that we record, you know? And then, yeah, Eugene Rodriguez from Los Inzontles, an amazing Latino cultural center and a band that he has started. We're doing music, and Eugene's in it. And I've been a Los Lobos fan. I saw them play New Year's Eve at the Fillmore when I was 16, and I'm 50 now.
Nice.
With Dwight Yoakam open for them. And they've been my favorite band forever, you know? And so when I wrote, I had to write the kind of anthem that starts off the movie for the credit sequence and stuff. I always heard David Hidalgo's voice. And so through Eugene, we got the word out to David. And I had met him before for doing a fundraiser for Los Inzontles, and he agreed to play guitar and do it. And then I asked Charlie if he would jump on for harmonica. He said absolutely.
And that's Inside of Us All.
Inside of Us All
is we'll finish off. Where can people get the soundtrack? And are Bay Area residents, which is our core listenership, going to be able to see the movie? What's their best way to do that?
So the soundtrack is coming out August 2nd. Soundtrack will be out August 2nd via Ropadope. And in fact, snippets are dropping now. We have a really amazing new version of New York, New York, the poem by The Last Poets, written by Abia Dunno Uoli, who also is in the film as a street poet.
Yeah.
And again, that goes back to my youth. My dad had The Last Poet albums around the house, and he came to the first SF Jazz gala that I ever hosted. So when I knew we needed a counterbalance, a bookend to the other New York, New York, we called him to see if he would spit that poem. And then David Sanchez's music behind it makes it soar. So that has already sort of dropped online. But Ropadope, August 2nd, you can get the soundtrack that is pretty wonderful. And then to see the film, we are probably going to figure out how to release it by November. So it should be in a theater near you by November. Otherwise, there are some festivals that are coming up. And you know, you probably could just call me. But, you know, hopefully you have a festival. Hopefully you want to see it. Hopefully there's distribution. Some of that has to be wrapped up. You know, clearly you have to keep a tight ship around that stuff. But, again, that's not the way I go through life. So I'm not worried about it. I want more people to see it and to experience it and to spread the word.
All right. Well, I looking forward to it. I enjoyed it. And my grandfather's from Mazatlan, and I know she's going to love it. I immediately saw this, and I'm like, I'm going to watch it again with my family. So when it comes, I'm going to check it out, and soundtrack on August 2nd.
That's absolutely, yeah. And we should probably give a quick shout out, too, to Richard Cabral. Who's fantastic in the film. I mean, there's so many people who are fantastic aside from Edward and Ryan. Glenn Turman is in the film, who's up for an Emmy right now, who's in Cooley High, and before that was in the first production of A Raisin in the Sun, you know, with Sidney Poitier. I mean, he is fantastic.
I'm glad I didn't, when you said his name, blurt out A Different World, because that's...
A Different World, that's true. Or he's known as the mayor. Willie Brown told me that he saw him in town, and he said, hey, it's the mayor. He said, no, you're the mayor, because he played the mayor on The Wire. And Chelsea Gillian has this unbelievable kind of breakout role in the film as well. She's fantastic as a woman who's an American mutt that helps... Fernando with his father as well. So it is a pretty good eclectic film, and a lot of San Francisco, because we're an eclectic city.
Well, congratulations on it, and thanks for coming to the Chronicle.
Thank you. This is my morning cup of coffee. I still get hard copy. I still read the Chronicle hard copy in the Times every morning. Bad reporter?
I sit right back at him. He's a good guy.
He's awesome.
Thanks again. Thanks for coming.
Thank you both.
Thanks, Robert.
You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to Aydin Vaziri and our guest, Robert Mailer Anderson. Our producer today is me, Peter Hartlob. Supervising producers are King Kaufman and Libby Coleman. Executive producer is Tim O'Rourke, and our editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. Our music is Midnight Special by Ease Jammy Jams. read our columns, and subscribe to The Chronicle at www.sfchronicle.com. Chronicle podcasts are on Apple Podcasts and other streaming services. Listen at www.sfchronicle.com/podcasts with an S.